It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.rir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
And this gets to the second argument that's being made about why we shouldn't extend the federal program. There are many who argue, and Senator Rand Paul recently argued, that these benefits keep the long-term unemployed from looking for work. There's no empirical support for that at all. Surveys of the long-term unemployed find that not only do the benefits keep them looking for work and enable them to look for work because it provides the means they need to put gas in their car, to pay to reproduce resumes if needed, etc., but there's also a requirement that anyone collecting unemployment benefits has to be actively seeking work. The Heldrich Center surveyed long-term unemployed workers over a period of several years, and what it found was that long-term unemployed workers who are getting benefits are more actively engaged in work search activities. They engage in more of those activities, and their engagement is much more aggressive than for those folks who are not engaged.
Christine Owens from the National Employment Law Project explains why unemployment compensation encourages, not discourages, the unemployed to get jobs, and why these federal benefits must be restored. And during this week's News You Can Use, we revisit what a tenant should do if billed for the cost of bedbug treatment. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 225, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.rir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Virginia law does not specifically mention bedbugs. The law does not explicitly say whether landlords or tenants are responsible for getting rid of bedbugs. Virginia law does require all landlords to follow building and housing codes affecting health and safety, and to make all repairs needed to keep the place fit and habitable. Because bedbugs make rental housing not habitable, this means landlords are responsible for getting rid of bedbugs. Under Virginia law, tenants must keep their rental units free from insects and pests. They also must promptly notify the landlord of the existence of any insects or pests. Notification of the landlord makes no sense unless the landlord also is responsible for getting rid of insects and pests, including bedbugs. If a tenant does not promptly report insects and pests, including bedbugs, the tenant could be responsible for the added cost of treatment due to the tenant's delay in reporting. Under federal law, the latest policy from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, Notice H-2012-5, issued April 22, 2012, stresses that tenants have to pay the costs of treatment only if treatment is needed due to carelessness, misuse, or neglect on the part of the tenant. A March 15, 2011 memo from the Chicago Regional HUD office stresses that responsibility for bedbug treatment lies with the landlord, noting that, quote, it is virtually impossible to prove fault with regard to who may have created the bedbug infestation within a property, end quote. unless the treatment is due to carelessness, misuse, or neglect by the tenant. If a landlord does bill a tenant for the cost of bedbug treatment, the tenant should not ignore the bill. The tenant should write the landlord a reply letter. The letter should say the tenant denies owing the bill because the tenant has no responsibility to pay for the cost of bedbug treatment. The letter also should say that none of the future payments, rent or otherwise, to the landlord may be applied to the bill for the cost of bedbug treatment. In addition, when the tenant makes future payments, rent or otherwise, to the landlord, the tenant should write a letter with each payment. The letter should say exactly how the payment is to be used, for example, for March rent. The letter also should say that none of the payment may be applied to the bill for the cost of bedbug treatment. Finally, if the landlord files a lawsuit against the tenant because the tenant did not pay for the cost of bedbug treatment, the tenant should get legal help right away. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Congressional inaction last month ended federal emergency unemployment compensation for 1.4 million workers right after Christmas. Christine Owens from the National Employment Law Project explains why unemployment compensation encourages, not discourages, the unemployed to get jobs and why these federal benefits must be restored. Here is the first part of Ms. Owens' comments.
So I think we'll move to Chris now, who's going to speak about the extremely pressing issue of unemployed workers who are about to fall off an economic cliff. Chris?
Thanks a lot, Fran, and thanks to Coalition on Human Needs for hosting this webinar and to all of you who are participating today. As Congressman Ellison and Debbie Weinstein have both noted, one of the real casualties of this budget deal was the Federal Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program, and specifically the failure of Congress to renew that program. It expires at the end of this year. It expires, frankly, at the end of next week. Congress has failed to act, and as a result of Congress not acting to renew the program, it has effectively cut off benefits to 1.3 million long-term unemployed workers who were receiving federal unemployment benefits, but whose benefits will abruptly end at the end of next week. Next week is the last week for which they will get federal benefits. And if Congress fails to renew the program when it comes back in January of 2014, we estimate that another 850,000 unemployed workers will reach the end of their state unemployment benefits over the first 3 months of the year. They will not be able to find jobs, and they will not have federal unemployment benefits to provide the sort of basic modicum of support that enables many to keep their heads above water. So by the end of the first quarter of 2014, well over 2 million long-term unemployed workers will have no federal unemployment benefits. That number will rise to almost 3 million altogether by the end of June. By the end of the year, it will rise to almost 5 million unless Congress acts. And I'm sure most of you are familiar with the federal program, but just for those of you who may not know, it's the program that kicks in once an unemployed worker has exhausted or collected all the benefits she's entitled to under her state program, still is unable to find work, still is looking for work, and has therefore been eligible to participate in the federal program. The program was actually adopted in the summer of 2008 when President Bush was still president. He signed it into law. It was the earliest time in a recession that the nation, had actually implemented a program of emergency federal unemployment benefits for long-term unemployed workers. It has been renewed 11 times since its initial adoption. It was expanded once or twice in among those renewals. But as you can see, the unemployment rate, and particularly the long-term unemployment rate and the duration of unemployment, has actually grown much worse since the program was first adopted in 2008. In the summer of 2008, 5.6% of Americans were officially unemployed, meaning that they told the census pollsters that they were unemployed and they were actively looking for work and had looked for a job in the last month. And of the 5.6% of Americans who were officially unemployed, 1.5 million were long-term unemployed. They'd been unemployed for more than 6 months. By 2010, that number had skyrocketed. So we saw that we had well over 4 million long-term unemployed workers. The rate of long-term unemployment as a share of overall unemployment in 2010 was about 45%, and the average weeks of unemployment exceeded 40 weeks. Now, those figures have improved slightly over the last year. Over the last year, the unemployment rate has fallen from 7.9% to 7%. Most of that is because people have simply dropped out of the labor market. And if you're not actively looking for work, you're not considered to be unemployed. We actually have the lowest labor force participation rate that we've had in 35 years, but none of that is reflected in the rate of unemployment. So although the unemployment rate has dropped to 7%, that's really not a realistic measure of the hardship out there in terms of finding jobs. If we factored in all of these missing workers, people who've dropped out of or refused to join the labor force, unemployment today would be well over 10%. We'd have 5 million more folks who were in the labor market and looking for work but unable to find jobs. So unemployment today is 7%. The average duration of unemployment is 37 weeks, which is more than 10 weeks longer than the cutoff for state unemployment benefits in every state. And again, the number of long-term unemployed workers has exceeded 4 million. This is an unprecedented level for more than 4 years now. So we still have very severe labor market conditions that mean it is not time to end the program of long-term unemployment benefits for the long-term unemployed. The next slide simply shows you the number of weeks that have been available for the long-term unemployed, the number of weeks of benefits. On the left side of the slide, May 27, 2012 is the heading. That shows the program when it was at its most generous, and I'm sure many of you had heard about people being able to get 99 weeks of unemployment benefits, combining their state benefits, the emergency federal benefits, and the permanent extended benefits program. Congress rolled back that program back in February of 2012 and began paring back benefits so that by October of 2013, the total number of weeks that were available in the highest unemployment states, which is unemployment of above 9%, had fallen to 73 weeks of benefits. So that would be whatever the number of state weeks of benefits would be, plus a maximum of 47 weeks of federal benefits. At the time we prepared this table, there were only two states that actually qualified for this, for Tier 4, the greatest number of benefits. Unfortunately, conditions have worsened, and we now have four states that qualify for a total of 47 weeks of benefits. Those are Illinois, Michigan, Nevada, which has the highest unemployment rate in the nation, and Rhode Island. So while this seems like a generous amount of benefits, again, if you keep in mind that the average duration of unemployment is 37 weeks, that more than 1.5 million long-term unemployed workers have been unemployed for a year or longer, and that there are three officially unemployed workers for every single job opening, 47 weeks of federal benefits is not an especially generous federal program. And, of course, that ends next week for millions of American workers.
You've been listening to Christine Owens from the National Employment Law Project speaking about congressional inaction last month, which ended federal emergency unemployment compensation for 1.4 million workers right after Christmas. We'll be back in a moment. We continue now with the remarks of Christine Owens from the National Employment Law Project explaining how unemployment compensation encourages, not discourages, the unemployed to get jobs and why these federal benefits must be restored.
One additional slide reflecting on why ending the federal unemployment program is premature. This slide is actually taken from a recent report by the Council of Economic Advisors at the White House and the U.S. Department of Labor. It's a really great report, and it has a lot of good state-by-state information about the who has benefited from the federal program, how many workers in each state, as well as how many workers in each state will be affected by the cutoff. So I'd really recommend folks read that report. But what this chart shows, that if you look back at all of the emergency federal programs we've had since the 50s, when Congress first began adopting federal emergency programs, in every prior program, long-term unemployment rate, which means the share of the overall workforce that is considered to be long-term unemployed, in every prior program, that rate was less than it is today. Today, the overall rate of long-term unemployment is 2.6%, and the next highest rate at times of programs expirations has been 1.3%, which is what it was in November of 2003 when the program that was implemented at the beginning of former President Bush's term was finally ended. This slide reflects what the average monthly unemployment benefits are and how those benefits compare to average monthly household expenditures of the typical household. And I think it's important because the three arguments that are made against extending federal unemployment benefits are, first, that they cost us too much. We know that extending the program for another year would cost about $25 billion, though on net it costs considerably less than that because it reduces other public assistance costs and because it helps create or generates demand that helps create more jobs. But $25 billion for next year was what CBO scored the program at. Since the program was adopted in 2008, its total cost has been around $225 billion, and it has benefited 24 million unemployed workers and their families. It's a very cost-effective program. But nevertheless, critics of the program say it costs too much. As Congressman Ellison eloquently expressed in his opening remarks, it's all relative. If we have the capacity to raise the revenues needed to afford these costs by closing tax loopholes, by increasing rates on the very wealthiest among us, et cetera, Congress has chosen not to do that, and the Republicans have drawn a very fast and firm line against new revenues that involve the tax code. So the offsets for the federal unemployment program are not readily available. But in any case, if you look at what the individual benefits are, they average $1,166 a month, less than half of what a typical household's average monthly expenditures are. In fact, several hundred dollars less than what an average household's typical housing expenses are. And this gets to the second argument that's being made about why we shouldn't extend the federal program. There are many who argue, and Senator Rand Paul recently argued, that these benefits keep the long-term unemployed from looking for work. There's no empirical support for that at all. Surveys of the long-term unemployed find that not only do the benefits keep them looking for work and enable them to look for work because it provides the means they need to put gas in their car, to pay to reproduce resumes if needed, etc., but there is also a requirement that anyone collecting unemployment benefits has to be actively seeking work. The Heldrich Center surveyed long-term unemployed workers over a period of several years, and what it found was that long-term unemployed workers who are getting benefits are more actively engaged in work search activities. They engage in more of those activities, and their engagement is much more aggressive than for those folks who are not engaged. And if you were to translate the $1,166 into an average hourly wage, the fact is average unemployment benefits are less than the minimum wage. So they are simply not an incentive for people not to look for work. The final argument that some have begun to make, some economists and some opponents on the Hill, is that unemployment benefits actually keep employers from creating jobs. The argument is that because unemployed workers can collect benefits, they are not willing to take available jobs unless the wages are much higher than employers are willing to pay, so that unemployment benefits actually have the effect of driving up wages and discouraging job growth. There is not only no evidence that any employer has ever said that the reason it's not creating jobs is because of unemployment benefits, but the fact is wages have been falling for all workers over the last several years, and the notion that these minimum wage level benefits would actually deter people from looking for jobs or from accepting a job that paid slightly higher is, again, simply laughable. What we do know is that unemployment insurance has enormous benefits for the economy. Unemployment insurance benefits are the most effective stimulus. Every dollar invested in unemployment insurance benefits generates at least $1.60 in GDP growth. As I said earlier, the unemployment benefits keep the long-term unemployed actively looking for work. The Council of Economic Advisers has estimated that extending the federal program will support the creation of 240 to 300,000 jobs. J.P. Morgan and the Center and CBO have estimated that ending the federal emergency unemployment program will reduce GDP by 0.2 to 0.4%. We know that unemployment insurance helps families meet their basic needs, including paying their mortgage. And job loss is the number one reason for foreclosures. So once these benefits are ended for several millions of people, we can expect to see foreclosures on the rise again. And then perhaps most important, federal and regular unemployment benefits reduce the number of Americans who fall into poverty. Since 2008, the number of Americans newly falling into poverty has been reduced by over 11 million. In other words, 11 million Americans have been kept out of poverty by unemployment insurance benefits. Many of these Americans are children, as this slide shows. In 2009, close to a million of America's children were kept out of poverty by unemployment benefits. So it is an extremely effective and important anti-poverty tool. Finally, we released a report yesterday that shows that if the federal program is ended, we will be in a situation, if you look at the red line on the far right side of this chart, in which only 1 in 4 unemployed workers in America will be collecting unemployment benefits. That is a disaster for the 3 in 4 who won't be collecting benefits. It's bad for their communities. It's bad for the economy overall. We will have the lowest share of unemployed workers collecting benefits that any time since the Labor Department started collecting this data. We are a rich nation. We can do better than this, and we owe it to the people who have already paid the heaviest price in this downturn.
You've been listening to Christine Owens from the National Employment Law Project explaining how unemployment compensation encourages, not discourages, the unemployed to get jobs and why these federal benefits must be restored. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegebright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Victims of domestic violence are able to obtain emergency, preliminary, and permanent protective orders, but what else? Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when private attorney Chris Bernhardt explains how domestic violence affects child custody, child visitation, child support, spousal support, property division, and grounds for divorce. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegebright.